You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to accomplished UK fund manager James Thorne of Columbia Threadneedle. So welcome, James.
Morning, Paul.
Well, it's great to have you back on the show, especially given all the sort of the volatility over the past month. So maybe we can start there. Do you have any sort of broad thoughts on the sort of like what's been happening with Trump's trade tariffs, and specifically into the sort of the UK small and mid cap sector? Is it a buying opportunity, or is it sort of like get the tin hats out?
Well, I mean, it's been interesting, hasn't it? The volatility has been exceptional, almost, you know, waiting between gaps between tweets. But there are some things that are going to create, I think, some interesting trends over the next couple of years. And it's, you know, the trend is always your friend, as I was told when I started in the city. And, you know, the problem over the last few years is that people haven't really wanted to allocate a huge amount of capital to the UK market and to UK equities. And I think what's going on in the US is going to start to change that. We've already seen huge outflows of European assets out of the US market, weakness of the dollar, and I think that's going to continue. And this is all at the same time as a combination of the UK government wanting to encourage equity investment. And really, you know, people often sort of ask me, well, we just, you know, what is it that's going to support some of these incredibly good value businesses? And really, it's always capital flows. And capital flows are coming our way. They've been very negative, and that really is sort of the rising tide that will rise a lot of opportunities where there is just some very, very good value in some really high quality businesses where the tariff issues aren't really going to impact many of them.
Mm. What are the sort of the flows that will turn that? Is it basically a reallocation away from the States to international markets, or continued M&A, or just a change of sentiment away from passives? Because it has just been a really tough last 3 years.
Well, I think there has been a long-term trend of diversification of UK pension funds and other wealth assets into global products. Now there is, in some areas, there's some of that still to happen, but I think also there's been, you know, this idea of US exceptionalism that, you know, the Mag 7, these companies are really incredibly dominant and going to you know, people are able to buy themselves into every new technology, and therefore it's very difficult for others to compete. And I think it's starting to seem that some of that's unwinding. I mean, I think you've seen that with the Chinese competition in the car market with Tesla. I think you're seeing it with Nvidia. Certainly some of our investments are challenging that and helping the hyperscalers challenge that monopolistic position of Nvidia. So many of those platforms that were seen as, you know, sort of, you know, could never put a foot wrong, we're seeing some big cracks. And I think as a result of that, and also just really the fear of, you know, will the dollar maintain the strength of position it's had, has just meant that, you know, asset allocators don't want to be as overweight the US as they have been. And that really is rebasing asset flows into areas such as Europe.
Well, I could certainly do the bit of help in the sort of assets into small and mid caps. That would be absolutely fabulous. Now, if anybody wants to ask any James a question, please put them into the chat bot and I'll read them out. Let's start with the theme of tin hats and run your winners. We've got Kenring in defense. It's a real sort of like done very well, obviously, given the backdrop of the Ukraine war and sort of like problems out in the South China Sea and also in the Middle East as well. It does the flares and it does energetics and effectively ammunitions and explosives, and also it's got a big rogue division. The shares have done very well, but I think the management team pretty ambitious, hoping to sort of almost double revenues over the next 5 years. Is this a run your winners and keep the tin hat on?
Well, I mean, I think any management team that comes out and states that they want to double revenues in the next 5 years to over $1 billion has got ambitions. But you know, Mike and the rest of the team, they're a conservative bunch. They've only said that because they really believe they can deliver it, and they can see that in those businesses. And you know, some of the areas you talked about, you know, some of these are funded by the EU with grants that they are there to support critical investment to expand their capacity in, as you say, energetics, but providing, you know, critical defense capability across Europe. And so the returns on that investment are going to be very, very strong. And as you say, you know, energetics, what does that mean to people? Because, you know, I certainly really have to scratch my head. But, you know, low orbit satellites that everyone knows about, these communication networks going up, has to relies on a very large number of satellites. And the energetics are effectively, you know, allowing the launch and separation of that. But also people like Martin Baker, who produce ejector seats, you know, they're putting in place long-term contracts to make sure they've got the assurance of supply. Well, people only do that when they've looked around the market and they can't find anyone else with the expertise to deliver it. And Roke, you know, Roke has been around since the Second World War, operating out of, you know, a very large HQ in the beautiful Hampshire countryside, with some incredibly bright people, you know, world class, doing product development in communications, cybersecurity, and areas of AI. And you know, that business has got a lot of, back to the point, your trend is your friend. Those trends are going to continue in the demands. And that is a business that's not just popped up over the last couple of years. As I said, this has been around for the last 70, 80 years. And the management are quite prudent and have been investing for growth. And I think, you know, it's most likely that those trends will continue.
So just for clarification, I always thought energetics was something to do with things that go bang, you know, basically. So, but it isn't. It's basically no. What we're talking about is ejector seats, are we? And
well, anything that needs moved quickly. So you need to separate a satellite launching system quickly, use energetics. If you want to separate a missile system from its launch, you know, launch bay, use energetics. They're not explosives per se. They're not the ballistic components. They are the bits that get things from one place to the other very, very quickly. I.e. a pilot in a plane, out of the plane very, very quickly.
Wow, God. Okay. Well, thanks very much for that explanation. I was totally off the out of order there. Right. Okay. Let's move to another industrial company. We've got Avingtraz, which is in regulated industries. It's got quite a big business now in the States. It does sort of things like blast proof doors for high speed trains with HS2. It also does nuclear decommissioning the storage boxes. It does nuclear extension and also does HVAC systems for the big data centers out in the States. Come out with a good trading update recently ahead of its new year end. I think it's in May or something, with good visibility. But clearly, obviously, the shares have come down because people are getting worried. What's your sort of latest thoughts on this one?
Well, the great thing about having trans is that, you know, they are, you know, a business management team who really know what they're doing. And they've invested in these businesses because they can see great opportunity. And if they didn't see great opportunity, they'd sell them. So it's not like a management team that are trapped with a set of companies that, you know, may get into difficulty and don't work. Their core engineering business has, as you say, got these lots of fantastic niches where they're market world leader. There's some opportunity for growth, everything from, you know, elongating old nuclear plants to investing in, and developing new nuclear plants to, as you say, really strange niches like blast doors. And then on top of that, you've got these, you know, really innovative medical imaging businesses. One is in 3D x-ray systems, which, you know, I encourage people listening to this to go onto the Adaptics website and have a look at what 3D x-rays look like, because, you know, it basically means you can look through any slice of a hand or a body part, you know, using an x-ray, whereas normally you would have just picked a certain level. It's really fascinating. And then the other side is these MRI scanners that don't need helium. And normal MRI scanners, the magnets that work in them need cooling with helium. And I was always told, you know, to try and get your head around it. If you imagine that, you know, liquid oxygen is like the cost of sparkling water and liquid helium is like a vintage Bollinger, you know, running a system off helium costs a lot of money. And if you can take out the vintage Bollinger, you save an awful lot of money. But also you can do it in easier areas like veterinary practices, small community hospitals. And so there's a big opportunity here. And, you know, at the moment, they're working up the distribution, scaling up manufacturing in Australia and the US. You know, so a lot of regional manufacturers are getting over some of these tariff issues. And that's one just to point out, I think, you know, where companies have regional manufacturing, so it's regional to regional, or are in very specialist niches, I think it gives you a lot of protection with this uncertainty going forward around tariffs.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think definitely be cracking open the champagne for that one.
Okay. It'll be an interesting year for having trans. Keep an eye on it. I think it'll be interesting to see what happens.
We've got Stefan. He's asking about a company called Inspect. I don't know whether you own it. It basically does... I think it does glasses frames and lenses for its own brands, licensed in, and also for sort of third parties. It's been around the houses, actually. It was IPO'd about 3 or 4 years ago. I think it's a bit of a turnaround. I don't know. It's quite a big business, actually. I don't know if you do you own it at all, know anything about it?
We do have an investment in Inspects. I think it's a business that's grown up since it was on the market. It's derated very materially. We got involved when we thought it was a turnaround. That turnaround is maybe taking slightly longer than we had expected. They've got a lot of capacity in Vietnam, not great on the announcement to tariffs. But again, you know, somewhere like Vietnam, I think, is a lot lower risk, because I would expect someone like Vietnam will do a deal with the US, because Vietnam has no choice but to be able to do that. They deliver, you know, not just making frames, but also lenses, mainly in the UK and European markets. Those markets have really suffered post COVID, where everyone, you know, sitting at home spent time to basically get a new pair of glasses, and the demand side really fell away. So, you know, I think historically this business wasn't quite as economically sensitive as you'd expect. It's not just like a normal consumer stock, but it was more a sort of a COVID hangover stock. And there have been some issues, as I said, around, you know, putting in that new capacity. I think the management are getting on top of it. It's taking a while, but the valuation is very, very depressed. Yeah. And as I said, I think one of the, you know, the final kick in the teeth was the Vietnam tariffs. But I think those tariffs are so extreme that, you know, that will have to be sorted out for the Vietnamese. Yeah, I mean, the balance sheet's in a good position. So, you know, I think they have the capability to work through their problems.
You probably find when private equity are looking at those type of businesses quite closely. Yes, yeah. Because it's given all the M&A. Okay, good. Let's move to another really high quality specialist engineering. We've got Oxford Instruments, which does scientific instruments for things like R&D, but particularly sort of materials and semiconductors. I think both two sectors are doing pretty well. You've still got a bit of an overhang, I think, of destocking in healthcare and life sciences. But the shares have significantly derated again. How do you see this one going forward?
Well, I think that, I mean, Oxford Instruments has just updated on its year end, the end of March, delivering, which, you know, when last year a lot of sort of specialist industrial companies struggled. I think there's two really interesting areas. I mean, obviously, lots of areas it operates in, as you've outlined. Again, back to the point, you know, the trend is your friend. Quantum computing, they make cooling systems for quantum computing. I think quantum computing, there are still a lot of people spending a lot of money progressing quantum computing forwards. And I think they're seeing a lot of good demand in that area of the market. And the other area is compound semis. And you might sort of say, well, hang on, what's a compound semi? Compound semi is simply uses more than two elements in the production. But these are areas of high rate data communication, so, you know, think IoT, power systems, things like augmented reality. There's a wide range of new technologies that all need compound semis, and they've invested very heavily in a very large plant near Bristol, and this makes equipment for people to develop compound semi production facilities. And I think that's going quite well. At the moment, Oxford Instruments makes no return on that facility. And that facility could grow very substantially over the next couple of years and should generate good margins. So I think there's some areas where Oxford has invested heavily and not yet seen the benefit of that. There are some negatives on the other side, you know, restrictions on budgets within, you know, US government departments could see a short-term impact potentially. But ultimately, these bits of kit are the bits of kit, you know, you need to do this research. You might have less research people doing it. I could see them pushing out some of the red tape. But these are the core instrumentation that you need in that research. So ultimately, you know, big research countries like the US ultimately will buy these pieces of kit.
So effectively, they also, you mentioned at the start, they do the cooling systems for the quantum computers, which take the temperature down to absolute zero, if I remember rightly from my chemistry days.
So yeah, like I don't think they -273.3 Kelvin, is that right? Or something like that. But yeah, so it's cold. You know, it's to stop vibration. You need very low signal to noise ratio in a quantum computing chip, so they have to be very, very cold, and it takes days to get the temperature down to that level and maintain it at that level. But yeah, Oxford Instruments is a world leader in making those fridges. I think more of a freezer, to be honest. I don't know why they call them a fridge. Bit beyond the fridge.
Imagine putting a Magnum ice cream in that. That'd be pretty tough. Okay, let's move.
I think it would shatter into a million pieces.
Probably would. Let's switch sectors. They go to consumer sort of like service. We've got PayPoint, which does the ATM machines that go into convenience stores, help people pay stuff. They also do drop-off points for e-commerce and collection points in those same stores. They've got, I think, Love to Shop or something, one of their websites, etc. They've sort of like shares have come down obviously with worries over the sort of the health of the consumer, but I think they're still doing pretty resilient actually.
Yeah, I mean, I think PayPoint, one, I think people get a bit confused. I mean, you just reeled off some of the things that they do. Mm. People get very confused about. I think you need to look at PayPoint in a really simplistic way, in that as the world becomes digitized, you still need a physical presence. And all of these independent shops that they have as, you know, their customers that then provide services to their customers, some of which you mentioned, is the physical network in the real world. And that's what connects you to the digital world. So, you know, as you said, they used to, you know, deliver cash. That's a declining market. And that's been the problem for PayPoint. It's had some declining markets. And it's through really all of those markets that really are slowly in decline and got into areas where there's substantial growth. So you think everything from banks that are closing their branches, where they're doing deals to provide cash services, so you want to pay some cash in or take some cash out, then effectively you can do that. But also areas like parcels. So Vinted, my teenage daughters are constantly selling their clothes now on Vinted. And that's good. That's, you know, recycling clothing and making sure that they don't just spend money and obviously get some money back from that. Well, you know, the Vinted network is basically into the PayPoint network. You have to drop a parcel off somewhere or collect a parcel. And, you know, Royal Mail is moving away from the post office network and PayPoint is starting to pick up that network. And that network effect is a very powerful mechanism for driving growth in the business. And the business has been doing quite well in some difficult markets. And I think, you know, as I said, as they've added these services and these services are in growth, that network is it's not unique, but it's one of the largest networks in the UK. And, you know, they've invested very heavily in making sure those services can be delivered seamlessly. That's why I think it's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly it pays a good dividend, actually, about 5.5%. And it's trading at about 9x forward PE. So it's.
Yeah. And it makes really good margins. So if it can move the top line, the growth and profitability, you know, mathematically accelerates quite quickly. So it's just getting over that drag of those legacy, as you said, people taking cash out of ATMs, which people do less and less now because of digital payment services.
Yeah, good. Another one which makes really good margins, Trainline, which basically sells tickets for people's transport across numerous different transport systems, train and coach and around Europe, etc. Obviously, there's a bit of concern in terms of the government's movement into sort of starting up the Great British Railways and whether they're going to start their own sort of like ticket website. How do you see? I know. How do you see this one?
Well, I think Trainline's a brilliant business. I mean, I've been following it since it IPO'd, and I mean, most of your viewers will have known it because, you know, most people at some point are traveling on trains. Mm. And I just think the seamlessness of the experience in terms of providing your ticketing, making sure you're getting, you know, the best price, what is very, very complicated system. And this has all become from, you know, when the train operating companies were allowed to operate separately and they've moved into Europe and there, you know, there's a liberalization of train services in Italy, Spain, France to come. Yeah. And they've built quite a good presence and they've shown that actually Trainline can defend its position against the likes of Uber. Uber's been advertising very aggressively in the UK and has taken a very, very small amount of market share. And why is this? It's because of the incredible functionality and ease of use of the Trainline, the Trainline app. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think if you've used it, you know, it makes a big difference. And if it works seamlessly, you use it. And you remember, you don't pay a fee. No one pays a fee if it's same day ticket purchase. If it's tickets in advance, you know, it's not you paying that fee, it's the TOC. And you know, the CMA is saying that there can't be any kind of economic advantage to the government body, quite rightly, because it has to be a fair playing field for all. And I just really, can you really believe the government's going to develop a website that's taken, you know, decades to refine? And even Uber, which is probably one of the most forward-thinking, technology-savvy businesses in the world, can't compete with Trainline. Do you think the UK government's going to be able to? I very much doubt it. So I just think this is a great high-quality platform business, and there's a lot of sentiment noise around it. And that's, you know, that seemingly to me probably creates an opportunity.
I do sort of sense a hint of cynicism there about the public sector being able to commercialise what their.
Well,
skills
if you can
are.
Find an example for me where they've managed to in the past, then I'll.
Well, I can't. You've rested your case and you've won. Yeah. I get it. Okay, we've got another one with really good sort of networking features. We've got Auction Technologies, which basically is a platform that connects. I think it's about 8,000 auction houses to bidders around the world, and obviously extends the buyer and the potential purchasers for particular curated items, things like antiques and, in fact, industrial products and stuff. It was one you talked quite highly about last time. How do you see it? 6 months on.
Yeah, well, I think the business is developing. I mean, to your point, putting all those buyers and sellers in one place is the key thing. Have you got the audience? And auction technology has got an incredible audience. And it's got some of the most well-known auction houses in the world sitting on that platform. The concern some people might have is, hang on, well, is this economically sensitive if there's issues around slowdowns? You know, auction technology was disproportionately hit post-COVID. It had a horrible COVID hangover as people, you know, stopped sitting in front of their computers at home and especially in the antique side. Normally, there's quite a nice balance. There's a bit of a hedge. You've got the industrial side, which, you know, in an economic slowdown, see secondhand prices pick up. People trade secondhand assets to a greater extent. So, you know, if these tariff implications have a slowdown of U.S. economic growth and, you know, it will push up secondhand prices, that benefits their RNC business. Their antiques business might slow slightly. So there's a nice hedge to the business. The core thing from here really is that, you know, you have that big audience and it's really putting in place, like the conversation on Trainline, you know, auction technologies platform is good enough for everyone who participates. But in terms of driving conversion and better usage of the site and actually success rates, there is a lot of opportunity. So, you know, it's not perfect at the moment, but the direction of travel is in the right way. The company has enough free cash to invest in those, and has already done a lot in terms of payment services, in terms of shipping services, to make the whole approach seamless. But if you look at, you know, some of the brands they operate in, which aren't necessarily sort of household names that you might consider, then, you know, there are bits of it that's still a bit clunky. It's nowhere near the Trainline level where you've got an app, you know, on your phone where it can all be done seamlessly. And with time, that's where you'll end up. And as a result of, I think, that audience continuing to grow, auction technology having that critical mass, that's a very powerful position to be in.
Mm. It's interesting, actually, observation. Yeah, because of the tariffs in the US, the secondhand values of the industrial and the commercial equipment is likely to increase, isn't it? Because the new equipment is so much more expensive.
Yeah, and then some of that will be domestic production, and domestic production will be increased, but that'll take time. You know, that's not going to happen overnight.
Yeah. Okay, let's just move a bit further down the food chain. We've got a question from Paul the Parrot. He's asking about Techmar, which I think does sort of really neat connectors for offshore wind and also for oil and gas in the North Sea. I think they've got quite a big contract. Is it the Dogger? I can't remember. There's a big wind farm anyway in the North Sea. I know it's a fairly small company. Do you own this one, James, at all?
I do have a small holding, and normally I wouldn't necessarily stay in a business of that size. I mean, it's tiny. Yeah. I mean, it's the smallest investment we have. And the reason being is Richard Turner, who I met a couple of times in the last 12 months. And he's been supported by the largest shareholders who have done a lot of, this is SCF Partners, a lot of investment in this space and really do know what they're doing. He is very, very impressive. And, you know, there are a lot of things that needed to change within this business, and that's already in tow. And they can see the size of the opportunity. And really for a CEO of his caliber to come into this business of this size, he's doing so because, you know, he can see the opportunity and he wants to grow the size of the business. Now, it will take some time to get traction. You know, I don't think it's suddenly going to inflect to massive growth. But he's lining this business up to basically provide engineering services across the full life cycle of offshore energy, whether it be renewable or whether it be some of those areas where, you know, there's a lot of decommissioning to be done. And I think there's a very big opportunity. And I think they have a very clear 3-year strategy on how to deliver on that. Now, you know, they've got to go and execute on it. I think from here, there's some interesting things that they can do. And as I said, you know, I'd hope we'll start to see progress as we get towards the end of this year.
Yeah. The UK, isn't it? It's one of the leaders, actually, in offshore wind. So they're certainly in the right geographical location. Okay, let's move to house building. We've got upmarket or mid-market house builder Crest Nicholson, largely sort of focused on the southeast. The shares are still trading at a massive discount to net tangible assets. Last time I looked, they're about 170 compared to a net tangible assets of about 270. How do you see this one? It's obviously been sort of like through the mill in terms of cladding and fire remedial saves. Are we getting the sort of the early shoots of a turnaround?
Yeah, I think. I mean, you know, what is the strategy here? Crest has had a decade of things unravel on it in the last couple of years. So, as you said, you know, cladding issues, but also complex sites. You know, they used to do a lot of really complicated brownfield sites with, you know, grade two listed buildings with all sorts of complexity. And they've had to finish some of those sites off. Those sites had very low margins within them, but also they had some land bank that had incredibly low margins for those historical issues. And they're getting through a lot of that. I think they were honest and they were upfront about the scale of the provisioning they needed to work through those cladding issues. So I think we've got a sort of a realistic base level. Martin Clark came in from Persimmon. He, you know, was their chief commercial officer. You know, he knows the hard yards. He knows how to run a house building business. And I think they're just doing all of the basics really, really well, making sure the managing directors of all of the business units are incentivized in the right way. And as you say, you know, this is trading at such a big discount to book value, such a disconnect to the other house builders. Mm. All you need to do is put all of that right and you get a significant uplift in the profit that the business generates. And that's really what they're on the path to do. And I think they've been through all of the really hard issues, you know, provisioning for all of these legacy. There is still some they still have to work through. Replacing that cladding, but it's all provided for, and I think they have a much better understanding of where that is. And then the rest is really just starting to build, you know, houses successfully with reasonable profitability. And I think we're getting closer towards, you know, seeing some evidence of that.
Yeah, I've just got a follow-up question from Toos. He's just asking broadly about the house builders. Is Crest the only one you own? And just in terms of the house builders in general, I think the government are planning to do a sort of like, or announce, is it building safety levy in the next sort of, I don't know, month or so, next few weeks. So any thoughts broadly about that, the house builders in the UK?
I don't have any comments on the building safety levy. We haven't had any details. I'd be surprised if there's a huge amount of red tape thrown at the house builders from, you know, the government policy. I think they have been working through the planning to make planning a lot easier. Crest is the only house builder we have, primarily because there aren't many in the small cap space in our benchmark, if you like. A lot of them now are FTSE 100 at the top of the 250, but we do like you know, the supply chain to house builders, but also people like LSL Property Services, which own, you know, the largest mortgage brokerage and mortgage advice bureau, because we do see a lot of remortgaging coming up. But also, actually, if you look at the forward yield curve, there are mortgage products now down at sort of 3.95 level. And I think, you know, if you were speaking to a lot of the companies we speak to in that financial services space, providing the mortgage market, you know, they're still seeing a lot of mortgage applications, even though we're going through the stamp duty hike, we've just been through it. There is a lot of pent up demand. And if employment rates can stay at a reasonable level through all this tariff uncertainty, then I think, you know, the pent up demand for housing in the UK is big. And the Labour Party wants to increase building, and, you know, the house builders are therefore very well positioned. But we're trying to play it across sort of the supply chain to the house building industry through mortgage provision, the house builders and the building product suppliers.
Yeah. And I think Crest actually did get a bid, didn't they? Is it from Bellway?
From Bellway, yes. Bellway, yeah. Which was always going to be difficult to execute on. Bellway is a very conservatively, very high quality house builder. I think, you know, Crest was still going through this turnaround. It was, you know, it was 12 months or so ago. I don't think it really fitted with what, you know, the Bellway shareholders want, which is a very consistent, very, very, very prudent approach to the market.
Yeah. Okay, let's stick actually with the construction area and infrastructure, more the digitization and the software. A company called Alico, which I think actually is reporting this week on Wednesday, it helps companies manage sort of like renovations and also building big infrastructure. And then once they've actually built a big sort of like, you know, building or a big property, then do the asset management on it as well. High margins. And I think they did last reporting, I think for last year, they had a trading update and said they did, I think it was overall 9% like for like with ARR growing in the teens. How do you see this one going forward?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, as you've said, you know, there is these industries that it operates in, the commercial building space, you know, is quite behind in terms of digitization. And to have software in place that allows you to manage the whole project of building an asset, but also then managing it post that. There are lots of providers in that space, but, you know, some of Elecosoft's products are very dominant in the UK and parts of Europe, and they're making good progress into entering into the US. And even in difficult backdrops, as you said, you know, the business has been able to grow at, you know, close to 10% organic growth. And, you know, this is a recurring revenue business model primarily now, having been through a SaaS transition. So it's got a high quality revenue stream. And hopefully, as it builds the size of the business, it can build its margins from that position. But, you know, it's also got a lot of cash on the balance sheet still, about 14 million. It's been acquiring complementary small businesses that, you know, where it makes sense for them all to sit under one umbrella. I think there's a big opportunity in that marketplace over the medium term. And in the short term, the business continues to deliver.
Yeah, and I think it did do a deal, didn't it? They bought a sort of like a consultancy, IT consultancy house, Vertical Digital, which is based in Eastern Europe. So if we ever get a sort of ceasefire in Ukraine, it might be well positioned to help out sort of like the whole reconstruction of that huge, huge, you know, country. But that's it was a longer term thing.
It's also bought. I mean, it bought a company called PMAC. And I mean, if anyone is, you know, if you look at PMAC's website, you know, you can see the quality of you know, a little small bolt-on that they bought, which is really just interesting that they're able to do acquisitions like that.
Yeah, good. Okay, let's move to another software company. Came out with a trading update last week, ActiveOps. It basically does software that helps largely financial companies, insurers and business process outsourcers to better manage their workforce in a hybrid environment to optimize the sort of the efficiency and the productivity. They really actually won a lot of new business at the back end in last year, and they seem to have continued that into the new year. They're growing, if I've read it correctly, like for like, constant currency, 15% top line, which I don't think I've seen very often in the UK for a software business. So obviously,
especially in this environment, I think there have been times when, you know, we've had software companies grow, you know, very fast rates. But, you know, ActiveOps, I mean, it's quite a dry subject matter. but you know what, you know, at the end of the day, it's really important. You know, they've won new customers in Canada and the US. As you say, these are people like National Bank, which we have not really heard of, but it's the largest bank in Quebec, and AIB and others. And this is really around driving, helping those banks drive customer satisfaction while not costing them as much money. So, you know, I think National Bank was saying it improved their productivity by 20%, and their NPS scores, because of the service they were offering to their customers, just got better. So, you know, as you say, it's about optimizing your workforce during the day, but also now getting into workflow. So how can we actually, you know, the workflow of certain aspects of opening current accounts, applying for mortgages, all of those aspects about improving that process. And there's some really clever tech embedded within that. But as you say, you know, the proof is in the pudding, and they keep winning customers, and they're growing very, very nicely. I think the problem for a lot of investors, it's just at that inflection. It's got an incredibly high quality base, you know, customers stay with them for a long time, but it's just at that inflection of moving into profitability. So, you know, it's on a high multiple, but if you look at it more on sort of what the potential of that, of the revenue line is in terms of their sales multiple, then it's not particularly expensive.
No,
as I said, you know, it's just at that inflection point.
Yeah, no, it's very cheap on a sales multiple for, I think it's like less than 2x. And 90% of this business apparently is recurring. You know, it's ARR, isn't it? High margin. So, and they're putting AI into their sort of software as well to help the clients.
I understand. And I think that's the great thing about application of AI. You know, it's almost, you do worry slightly, it's a marketing tool. I'll just sprinkle the words AI and see if I can charge my customers an extra 10%. But I do think in ActiveOps's case, you know, embedding AI toolkit into what is already productivity software just makes the productivity that much better. I can't give you any numbers on that. I'm not sure they'd want to give you that numbers, but you know, I think that is obviously working. And there are many other software companies where I think that is the quickest payback on AI, is where you already have great efficiency and AI is just making that software even better.
Yeah, your cynicism in AI is matched by your cynicism of the government with the train line, which is probably absolutely true.
No, we've got some really good AI investments, pure AI investments, yeah. Where I'm not cynical at all. But okay.
That's good. Okay, we've got another question from Stefan. He's asking about polling business YouGov, which was a star, I think. They basically have got a consumer panel of, I think it's about 30-odd million. They bought GfK, one of its rivals in Europe, about 18 months ago. And they've been through this the mill over the last 12, 24 months. I think the new... They've had a change of the CEO. Stefan Shakespeare has come back to sort of turn it round. How do you see its prospects here, James?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a lot of market speculation that, you know, that market had become a lot more competitive and YouGov was suffering from much higher competition. I think that might have been the case in a very small area of their market. I think ultimately the business lost its way. I think it was understandable what the management was trying to do. Steve Hatch came on board. You know, he'd had a great reputation. He'd worked for one of the big Mag 7 in Europe. And he came on board to sort of, you know, take it to the next level and corporatize it. I think the reality is that they put a lot of costs into the business and didn't really deliver on a lot of the functionality that they could. AI here plays a role, to be clear, Paul. And I think Stefan has stepped back in for the next couple of years just because, you know, it's back to the original strategy. And I think the original strategy is a very solid one. I'm surprised slightly that the market isn't giving them a little bit more credit in that they've got their, you know, their hands around the neck of the issues. And the last three times they've talked to the market, everything's in line. And that's in a really difficult market backdrop. And as I said, the market's not giving it credit for that. So, yeah, I mean, I've been invested in this since it IPO'd in the mid-noughties. And, you know, it had been a very successful investment. I think Stefan is a safe pair of hands. And it's, you know, it's back onto the original strategy that it outlined a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I was looking at the valuation. It's about, if I'm correct, it's about 5.5x forward EBITDA.
Been on that valuation.
What time of valuation typically are software platforms like this?
Well, I mean, it depends where it is, but let's simply say 15, shall we?
Yeah. Wow. I see you. Yeah. No, I mean, it just looks, well, again, another private equity target, probably this one, but
that's why it all depends whether, you know, yes.
Okay. Whether it be approved. Yeah. No, another one. Okay. Let's move to sort of telematics. We've got Microlise that has been really successful actually with its fleet management SaaS platform, winning new clients. It must be a quite competitive sector as well, but they've got to have a strong USP to be doing so well. How do you see this one progressing, James?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing is, I think it's an industry that's consolidating. Microlise's strategy is to offer end-to-end services. So you have all these small businesses doing one component of what they do, but they can't do all the components. And ultimately, I think what that means is the market will consolidate and some of these small businesses will sell themselves to Microlise. In the UK, it's got an incredible market share position. I've forgotten the threshold, but they sort of divide the market into two areas, larger fleets. So imagine the big national providers and then small fleets that are, that are operated by mum and pups. In the larger fleets, they have a 60% market share. And the retention rate of those customers is you know, getting pretty close to 100%. So that's an incredibly strong market position, and shows the stickiness and the resilience and the quality of their offering to their customers. Now, you know, I don't think that Nadeem, the founder and majority shareholder, would be complacent as to, you know, they've invested heavily and they have to invest to keep their customers happy. But I think that's, you know, the quality of their proposition is starting to show fruit in the international markets where they put some investment in. So, you know, Australia, New Zealand, parts of Europe, and I think that there are opportunities over time in North America. But again, to your point, you know, this is a business that's got a very sticky, very high quality revenue base that in a difficult market backdrop is growing at double digit. You know, I think in the last period for 2024, they grew 11%. And again, you know, the valuation for this type of business with the margins that it generates and the stickiness of the sales against global peers is incredibly low. And even on the UK market is low. I think, you know, it's going to continue to invest because Nadeem owns 50%, over 50%. And he wants to grow this business in the right way for the long term. I think it's incredibly high quality. And we really like what they're doing.
Yeah. I was just looking at the projected EBIT margins. They're about 8% for this year. And presumably Nadeem longer term is looking to increase that for a sort of, you know, SaaS type platform business with a one to many type business model, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've had very good conversations with the management about the desire to want to move those margins forward. I mean, this is not me forecasting or a prediction, but, you know, you look at SaaS business models, they're general, if they're operating and have the dynamic of the stickiness of the revenues, you operate on this rule of 40. So basically, the number of growth plus margin has to, you know, should equal about 40% to get that quality business. Now, proof is in the pudding about whether the business is high enough quality to get to that level. But, you know, we would hope over time you're in the low rule of 20s here. And the competitive positioning and structural positioning, you would think that over time we would close that gap between 20% and 40%. It won't happen overnight, but I think they've clearly have wanted to see the margins continually gently tick up.
Good. Okay, let's switch sector to sort of like leading edge healthcare. We've got Oxford Biomedica. It helped AstraZeneca develop and launch and manufacture its COVID virus. And I think it's US peer, correct me if I'm wrong on this one.
It's a COVID vaccine, I think you're there.
Yeah, okay, sorry,
COVID, not the COVID virus.
COVID vaccine, yeah. The sort of like USP is they've got viral vectors that help active ingredients, but natural ingredients and gene edited properties into cells that can then be injected into a human to give the benefits of that particular treatment. I think they're just about sort of getting to an inflection point of profitability. But how do you see this one? Very sort of like difficult technology to get your head around.
I'm not trying to say I'm a great expert. I mean, I think when we're looking at these sorts of businesses, we like to sort of have some longevity of their presence in the market. Oxford Biomedica has been operating for over 30 years. You know, they came out of Oxford University originally, were, you know, one of the leaders in developing actually, you know, the actual compounds for these gene and cell therapies. And I think that's a much higher risk market. Now, you know, they've realized that they had amazing process technology in terms of manufacturing, as you say, and scaling up these viruses you then use in cell or gene therapies. Won't go into that. People can go and Google cell and gene therapies to how it works. And there've been some very successful drugs such as Novartis's Chimera for treating cancer in the marketplace, and there was a bit of a hiatus, but there's now a huge number of drug targets in the pipeline, over 1,500 being developed either in clinical or preclinical. And we think many more of those are going to come to commercialization in the next few years. But this business is quite diversified. It's not reliant on one individual drug. Oxford Biomedica having, as you said, you know, helped AstraZeneca, and it did it at a zero cost and return on capital, so that they made some actual cash profits, but they didn't make a return. But what it allowed Oxford Biomedica to do was really scale up some of their manufacturing and the knowledge base around some of that scaled manufacturing. The other key thing that they understood was that their customers really need standardization and quality. And quality was everything to basically outsource all of their manufacturing in these areas. And a lot of these biotech companies have realized that it's not their expertise to be able to do this. But also the major global CDMO companies don't have the same level of specialization or the 30-year history that Oxford Biomedica has. And really, they consolidated two other players in the market, Homology in the US and Institute Mérieux in Europe. So they have manufacturing now in France, in the UK and the US. Important also from a tariff point of view, if these were to be included. But as you say, you know, this business is going to inflect. It's, you know, it's bumbling around sort of cash break even. It will lose a little bit of money in the first half, probably. But, you know, the management have guided that they expect to continue to grow at 35%, the revenue line, and get to 20% EBITDA margins. Well, I mean, you know, you can give your own views around what those businesses sort of valued at. But, you know, there are competitors in this marketplace, but I don't think anyone who's got a global manufacturing footprint or can scale the manufacturing of some of these products. And I think really for gene and cell therapies to take off, the costs of these therapies are incredibly high. And really to get the costs of them down, you have to scale up the manufacturing. And that's why a lot of customers, a lot of clients are really interested in what the team and Frank Matthews has done an incredible job of getting the business to this position to be able to allow those customers to have the confidence of being able to scale up production as they move towards commercialization.
Yeah, will they have to do another fundraise? Because I know they've got cash on the balance sheet, but I think they've still got, or they did last year, have quite a hefty cash burn.
All of the forecasts and the analysis as it sits today indicate that they would not need any further sources of funding to get to profitability. Obviously, there are variables to that. So, but that's what is the market's forecasting.
Yeah, you'd have thought they'd probably, given they're growing at 35% per annum and they're reaching an inflection point, if they did need to raise money, then it'd be pretty easy. Well, it may. Who knows? I suppose.
Well, I hope. I mean, I think they've materially de-risked the delivery of what they've outlined in their medium term, and the market has not given any credit for the fact of to the level in which they've de-risked the business. And I think that's just because we're in, you know, we've been in a bit of a bear market. So businesses that are this sort of inflection are less of interest to people, which is totally understandable. But as I said, I think the team has done an incredible job of de-risking it, and the momentum in terms of the number of customers that want to work with Oxford Biomedica has grown quite substantially. And I think that shows the quality and the demand for this proposition in that marketplace.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there aren't many companies who are increasing the top line in this market by 30-35%, and even if it's got competition, it's got something, hasn't it, that does it. I like it. Okay, let's switch sectors. Let's go to indie gaming. We've got Everplay that has its own stable of titles and a big back catalogue that I think generates most of its income, but also develops for other sort of third parties, again reaching a sort of like an inflection point. It's turning around. The shares have been hit obviously as people came out of COVID and stopped playing as many sort of mobile games, but how do you see this one going forward? I think it used to be Team 17, I think, James.
It used to be Team 17, hello, can you hear me? Okay,
yeah, go on. Yeah, I can hear you. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it did. It did used to be Team 17. And they changed the name because they didn't, you know, usually companies change their name because they're trying to hire, rebranding. Yeah. Everplay changed its name because they just felt that some of the other really great brands that sit within it weren't getting the sort of the, the air coverage they deserve. Toy Stories, I've forgotten the name of it now. There you are. That's the point. It was always overly hidden. But anyway, I mean, the Astragon, there we are. I think the reason why Everplay is in such a great position is that, you know, they really focus on gameplay that people want to play year in, year out. So, you know, there's always the AAA title that people want to go and buy. Grand Theft Auto, forgot what number one now, 6 or 7. But, you know, this business is in everything from construction simulator, firefighter simulator. These are all sort of Astragon's sort of specialisms, to Toy Stories, which is, you know, sort of preschool, young, you know, Thomas and Friends, you know, Duplo World, but also some really amazing indie games like Hell Let Loose, and Overcooked. And Overcooked has been, you know, has been around for a long, long time. And originally this business started with Worms, which, you know, people who are into gaming, you know, people in their 50s will have known, 50s and 60s will have known, I think, when Worms was around. So it's a platform that has huge longevity. And as you know, what we're looking for, Paul, we're looking for growth businesses, but growth businesses that can maintain that for the long term. And Everplay has shown in what's been an intensifying and incredibly competitive industry that they're able to continue to grow, but also to do that in a very disciplined way while generating good levels of cash. And that means you're not, you know, anyone probably can create an amazing game, but they could have spent a fortune doing it and never recruits their investment. And so, yeah, I think it's really impressive what Everplay have managed to deliver, and the breadth and diversification of games that they have, and the back catalogue and the strength of growth from that back catalogue gives you know, a great comfort of resilience.
Yeah, it looks cheap as well, 11.5x PE with lots of cash on the balance sheet. So, I think this is a very, very good business. Let's move to sort of financial service. We've got a company I've never covered before, actually, in 5 years. So thanks for this one, James. slightly bigger, Bridgepoint Group. They're about 2.2 billion market cap. They're a specialist in mid-market private equity and private credit investments. What sort of attracted you to this one particularly? Because it's done very well.
Yeah, I mean, I've known Bridgepoint because, you know, from time to time they've come and tried to bid for companies we've been invested in.
Yeah.
You know, they've got a great reputation in the European mid-market space. So I kind of feel that they're sort of slightly our competitors in terms of, you know, they're investing privately in businesses of the same sort of size that we would be investing in. And they've had an amazing track record in growing their AUM from, you know, the early noughties all the way through to where we are now.
Yeah.
And they've got a lot of ambition. And they're very, very good at what they do. So their track record and their performance is very, very strong. And there's a few trends in the market which I think will really benefit for them. I think the private client market wants to get into alternatives. I think that they've got into the credit market and they've shown that they're capable of growing in that market. But also through ECP, which they bought, infrastructure in the sort of power market in the US, one of the leading players in that marketplace, they can show that they can consolidate the market, and there's a real benefit to growing the scale but diversifying the business in sort of world leading alternative niches, and I expect to see a couple of further acquisitions in the next couple of years from Bridgepoint. But I think what is misunderstood is the quality of the portfolio. You know, the growth that Bridgepoint gets from its underlying assets are from EBITDA growth, not from leverage. I think everyone assumes that private equity just gets its returns from leverage, not in the mid-market space. The visibility of revenue, which we've talked a lot about this morning, is incredibly high in the Bridgepoint portfolio. So, you know, they give data on their companies, and you know, it's approaching 80% revenue visibility for the year forward, and very strong cash conversion. And they only invest in areas of the market where, back to that point of the trend being your friend, where there are really good, strong trends. And, you know, businesses naturally have an inbuilt quality to them in terms of they're not highly economically sensitive. And that's landed Bridgepoint in good stead. The performance of their funds for their clients has been incredibly strong. And as a result, they've had very good AUM growth. I think in the short term, the market worries. And the reason why the shares have been sold off in the very short term is because they worry that the company can't do realizations of their assets. Right. Another point here is that, you know, historically, Bridgepoint has seen a 28% uplift on those assets when they sell them. That's partly back to that point of EBITDA growth is the main value accruer to their investments. And they value those at the end of the year, but then they sell them on the run rate of EBITDA. And that's, and then generally the sale of assets comes at the end of the first half into the second half. And their credit book has been incredibly, incredibly strong. But as I said, it gets sold off because, you know, there is leverage in the portfolio. We think it's relatively modestly leveraged versus history. And they have generally performed very resiliently in a difficult economic backdrop. So, and I think what people forget is that you price these assets off the forward yield curve. And obviously, as we're going through potentially, you know, it's one of the outcomes might be a slowing global growth. Interest rates are likely to come down, the forward curve is likely to come down, and that actually prices high quality assets that Bridgepoint invests in upwards.
Yes.
So there is actually a sort of embedded hedge in the book value of their assets, which I think is quite often missed in the short term by the market.
Mm. And they've been able to raise quite a lot of new funds, haven't they, as well? You know, their actual fundraising in a tough market has been pretty good, actually, or it seems to be.
Well, I think the key thing for them is, you know, as a relatively small player in global PE is it takes a long time to seed your client relationships to get them to allocate money. We're talking, you know, 5 years plus.
Yes.
And through the purchase of ECP partners, you know, you had really good synergies from that. So ECP partners had much better distribution in countries where Bridgepoint didn't, and therefore Bridgepoint can sell its products to those LP relationships. Now, it doesn't happen instantly overnight, but it certainly shortens the time frame to get those new customers on board, and vice versa. You know, ECP didn't have the distribution in geographies that Bridgepoint had very, very strong relationships. And Bridgepoint has got a very good diversified set of customers across pension funds and sovereign funds that, you know, I mean, I think in total, if you looked at about 80% is pension funds and insurance and asset managers. So these are long-term investors with long-term views. But as I said, you know, one of the key areas of growth for the alternative space and private equity is in high net worth individuals who historically haven't had the same access to the alternatives market.
Yeah, good. Okay, brilliant. Well, we're just coming towards the end. And I always ask all these sort of the experts a sort of final question, which is pretty, it tends to be quite tough. Is sort of, if you're putting everything together, what's your sort of like your favorite or most attuned stock to the current environment for the next sort of year ahead that you've seen?
Well, I'll...
It's
actually a really easy one. It's something that we have followed for a long time that historically I'd never really invest in for many reasons. And the reason investing in it is the timing is because of the market backdrop. But the reason for investing it is really because of the CEO. And what he's done historically, and that's Brian Cochrane. Brian Cochrane went into Betfair when everyone thought Betfair was a bit of a busted flush, saw the opportunity in that business. Ultimately, it was bought by Paddy Power, and Brian carried on at Paddy Power, did an incredible job of that business, and then sort of continued. He came into IG Group a couple of years ago. Yeah, he saw a big opportunity in terms of that customer base and to diversify, but also deepen those relationships, those customers globally. you know, IG Group will have benefited materially. You saw plus 500 this morning reporting very good results from volatility. Volatility was quite light in the first half of last year, picked up in the second half. We know they had a good Q4, good Q1. I think that will be a big benefit to them. But I think the medium term story is also starting to improve. Their new customer numbers are picking up. And, you know, Molten Ventures, which is an investment of ours, you know, we'd known Free Trade, which we thought was a great business, growing very strongly. IG Group has seen an opportunity really in terms of acquiring Free Trade. It's a different customer set. I think they can see a lot of opportunity with what they do with those customers. And I think there's been a lot of operational change in IG. And I think the market backdrop is very interesting for it. But also there's a very interesting medium term story here.
Yeah, I think you got your timing right there perfectly, James, given the volatility. This is definitely a counter-cyclical play, given all, you know, what Trump's been doing. So thanks for that. That's absolutely brilliant insights. Thanks, everyone, for your questions as well. And look forward in touching base again in 6 months' time, James.
Thanks, Paul.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair has got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.